everybody, welcome to the I'm a Rescue podcast. I am Tom Clark, and today we have an old friend on the show, John Garrett. John is a very funny comedian. I met John, he'll have to remind me of the year, but we met pretty early on when he was starting out. I think I was on my way out of Milwaukee. But John has gone on to have a very successful career as a corporate comedian, corporate speaker, and he is clearly you can't see the video. I don't know if we'll show the video, but he's a Notre Dame fan and a graduate, just like my brother. And he's very funny. So let's introduce him. John, how are you?
I'm doing great, man. Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, it's probably been almost 20 years now that we've known each other.
Yeah, so we met. What year did you start in comedy?
Yeah, I mean, 2000. February 1st, 2000 was my first time on stage, and then moved to Milwaukee shortly after that. So we probably met around 2001. Yeah, yeah. It was when you were kind of Chicago and then, you know, L.A. bound.
Right. Sure. Yeah. And you were friends with a lot of my friends, Tyler Kroll.
Tyler and I, and then like Dave Tooney, and did some of the comedy sports as well. Mm-hmm. There in Milwaukee, Eric Price and those guys. And yeah, and actually Tyler and I, and then Jason Roberts, we used to drive to Madison, Wisconsin comedy club on State Street. They had an open mic every Tuesday, I believe. And then we would drive to Madison every Tuesday and do open mic, and then the Safe House in Milwaukee as well, doing the shows there on like Thursdays, I feel like.
Yeah. I always think if you told somebody what you'd have to do with stand-up comedy, like, you would never do that. But when you're in the situation, you just do it, right? You drive to Negaunee, Michigan to perform at a pizza place for – $200,
and you're like, if you're lucky.
But
if you get pizza, you got to pay half price.
Right, 50%. I love when clubs or just anyone, they give you a discount, like half off. Like, come on. Like, what is wrong with you?
It's like, I already gave you a discount on my fee. Right. You know, like, I'm not charging you as much as I should.
Oh my gosh. Obviously for me as a comedian with the pandemic, work, obviously I haven't done any live shows since the middle of March. How has it been for you? And I've done a couple Zoom shows, but obviously the money isn't there for that. What have you been doing as far as with corporate comedy?
And the Zoom shows are weird too. I mean, they're exhausting for me. they really are, because I feel like, you know, when you're doing a live show, you're getting that instant feedback and there's that energy from the audience that you can feed off of, and it kind of fuels you. Right. But, you know, I'm bringing the same, you know, energy to it, but I'm not getting it back. And so when it's over, I'm like, I need a nap. Like, I'm exhausted. Like, this is, it's just wears me out. It really does. And, you know, I haven't done a ton. I mean, I had a lot of conferences lined up, you know, like for executive retreats and associations and things like that, you know, speaking, doing like opening keynotes for it. And they all canceled. Some of them punted to next year. A few of them went virtual, but they're a lot smaller and shorter, which is what they should be. There's no way it should be 6 or 8 hours of.
Oh my God. That's like a punishment. Yes.
And as an audience member, the thing is like with the virtual, like it's not as good as live, but you can definitely do some really, really cool things. Mm-hmm. Like with your green screen, I mean, all of a sudden we're on the moon, you know, you're performing on the moon, or we're performing wherever you want it to be. And so technology wise, you can make it a TV show if you want. And so I've done some of that. Like there was a firm in North Carolina that I did a college recruiting event with, and it was 2 days, like 2.5 hours each day. And I basically made it a TV show. We had like an opening theme song, like video and like a TV show, and different camera angles just within Zoom. You can, you know, make it spotlight different people, or, you know, have people on their phone doing an office tour, or, you know, things like that.
It's definitely, I think it's just comedians get very stuck in their ways. And I feel like there's some comedians are like, I'm done. I'm not doing anything. I'm just going to wait this out. Yeah. And I just think like, this is kind of the way of life for the next, I mean, I think it could be over a year. I think we might get into March of next year and still be sort of in a similar situation because we're not doing anything to, to help the country. We're not taking this seriously. Half the country is, half the country isn't.
Right. And then, you know, every other day on the news, it's something that contradicts whatever they said 3 days ago. And it's like, well, what's real anymore? what is happening?
It's frustrating. But I wanted to get into a little bit. So you started around 2000. How'd you end up in Milwaukee?
Yeah, so I was working with PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC. Okay. I was a CPA. I graduated from University of Notre Dame, went straight to PwC, was doing merger acquisition type work and internal audit. And then a national partner recruited me to be on the FirstStar Bank engagement. FirstStar was the largest financial services client that PwC had. And so I was hand selected to be on that, which told me that I didn't suck at what I did, so then I moved to Milwaukee from St. Louis, where I went to high school and then where I'd started. And yeah, so then that's what brought me to Milwaukee. I had a lot of friends in Chicago, so it was kind of close, you know, so I was like, all right, that's kind of cool, but it's not as big as Chicago. So it's kind of fun and I loved Milwaukee. Milwaukee was fantastic. I lived downtown the whole time and yeah, it was great. Oh, wow. Really great. Yeah.
So you're one of those comedians that had money.
I guess it's all relative. I mean, you know, like it's I remember, yeah, when my very first exposure to comedy, well, was in college, David Spade came to Notre Dame, but I don't necessarily count that as like, cause that's a celebrity. And no matter what he said, it was going to be hilarious when you were a college kid. But then PwC had me at a training in LA in Pasadena. And so it was for 4 weeks and there were four of us that would rent a car from the DoubleTree in Pasadena and drive down to the Improv every Thursday night, because Whose Line Is It Anyway was filming in studio.
Right.
And then they would come down to the Improv and do an uncensored, not Wayne Brady, but like Colin Mochrie and Drew Carey. And yeah, it was great.
I used to host some of those shows and that was some of the best.
It was crazy. But and then before and after, I mean, it was like a 3-hour show overall. And so, you know, there would be stand up before and after doing, you know, 10 or 15 minute sets. And that's when I began to realize like, oh, wait, it's not like what Comedy Central shows where everyone's hilarious and there's laughter all the time. It's like, no, sometimes the jokes bomb. And and so I was like,
hope.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, I could be as not funny as that guy. And this is awful.
I like that approach. Is I can be as not funny as that guy.
Right. I wouldn't be the worst person that ever did comedy. And so I was hanging out in the bar area. Drew was super approachable. It was really cool to talk with him. But then Vince Morris was there. And so I was talking to him and I was like, how do you do this? And so he's like, you just go up and record it and then listen and then tweak it and go back again. He's like, so what do you do now? And I go, well, I'm a CPA with PricewaterhouseCoopers. He's like, well, you got to do something, you know, like as if I was delivering pizzas or slinging hamburgers, you know, like,
right. That's funny that, when I came out to LA around 95 to visit, actually my brother's a Notre Dame graduate.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And he and I went to the Notre Dame USC game and we went to the Improv. I was just starting in comedy. So that was sort of an awakening of watching, pretty big names. I remember, I think maybe like George Lopez was doing a set before he was big. But I remember the same thing of like, oh, that guy is not that funny, or this, you know, the people that would blow you away, blew you away. But one thing I did notice was just the recurring themes. Like it was a lot of Michael, at the time it was Michael Jackson, John Wayne Bobbitt, OJ. So that every comedian had a joke about those three subjects. And I was like, well, I guess that's what you got to do, is you got to write those jokes. So it's funny how your mind, how we, when we started our, when I think late 90s, none of us knew how to do comedy. Like now you can watch YouTube and you get exposed to all these comedies.
Right.
Or you'd have to go to like Blockbuster and right. 12 comedy videos they had available.
Yeah, or Comedy Central had, or like A&E's Evening at the Improv.
Right. You know,
just like little small little windows into what stand-up comedy supposedly was.
Right, and it was very, like you said, it was very, made it all look good. I mean, they enhanced it or whatever, but you never saw the ugly side of it, and now people see that side of it. So I feel like we definitely went through the trenches in that regard.
No, for sure. And people don't appreciate that. And I feel like it's a lot of creative people that have to go through that, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And people don't really value or appreciate, you know, what you've done. And, you know, if people listening, if you're at a comedy show or at a music thing and they're selling t-shirts, it's because they have to.
Right.
You know, they're not getting paid enough to make it home. So, you know, that CD is going to give them gas money, you know.
Right. That's what it is. I started selling t-shirts, and that was doubling my weeks at clubs.
Right. And even then it's not a livable scale. So it's not like, oh wow, doubling millions. No, it's doubling hundreds.
Right. And that's one thing I miss now with no live shows. It's like, I got all these t-shirts back here. I'm trying to unload. I got nowhere. Plus you can't interact with people. It's I never would have thought that this would be how comedy ends. It's a pandemic.
Well, and I feel like it's a combination of other things that are also happening now, where I'm kind of grateful to not be in the clubs anymore and not doing straight comedy, because I feel like everyone's offended at everything now, and it's like, I don't even know what you're allowed to joke about. It's
ridiculous how thin-skinned everyone is now. Like, yeah. I've never had so many shows where people are like, don't talk about politics, don't swear. Which I get if you're doing a corporate event or whatever, like you want to cater to that. But I mean, even like in clubs, like don't get political. And it's just like, we really need to address the elephant in the room. Otherwise we're never going to get beyond where we're at right now, which is just constant fighting and everyone just getting upset because you're talking about the president. And it's like, he's the elephant in the room. You have to make fun of him. Like, ridiculous.
And it's like, you know, as long as it's a really good joke, then it's great. You know, I feel like the problem is that sometimes, you know, in comedy, it's like, where's the joke? You know, that's just, you know, you're offering your opinion. Well, you have to make it funny. You're a comedian. You know, if it's a good joke, then it's a good joke and it deserves to be said. But if it's an opinion piece, well then, you know, just stand on a milk crate out in the corner and, you know, that's the thing is like, people go to the comedy clubs to laugh, you know, that's the thing is, I think people forget, and maybe social media has created these echo chambers that we all live in and these safe bubbles where we only hear what we want to hear. And then all of a sudden, wait, what? People have a different opinion than me?
Right.
It's like, yeah, on everything. I mean, good God, how do you go outside? Like, it's just, I remember the good old days where like, we all just like voted and then hung out because who cares, you know, like it's just like, you can still be friends, you know, type of thing.
Yeah. Social media has definitely divided everything, but I wanted, you went, like you mentioned about going from the clubs to doing corporate and I kind of had a similar awakening as far as like, I started teaching stand-up around 2008.
Yeah.
And then I started, when I got married, my wife, Steph, and I, we started booking more shows on our own, doing more independent venues. And I think because you saw sort of the writing on the wall of like, you know, if you're not a big name, clubs aren't going to book you, you know, at the big clubs you're not going to get into. And some of those mid-level clubs aren't paying that well, or they're not going to pay you that well because you're maybe not a draw yet. So what for you was sort of your awakening, or I mean, you started around 2000, so kind of describe that journey.
Yeah. So yeah, around 2000 in the Midwest, and then I guess in 2004, I guess. Yeah, I was in Milwaukee for about 3 years. 2004, I moved to Indianapolis and was fortunate enough to be on the Bob and Tom show several times.
Oh yeah.
Tom Griswold had seen me at the Funny Bone in Indianapolis and was like, "Hey, we got to get you on the show." And I was like, "That's awesome." Because in high school in St. Louis, I used to do driver's ed listening to Bob and Tom. Okay. And yeah, and it was hilarious because the driver's ed teacher was like, "You can pick the channel, but I choose the volume." So, you know, on comes some inappropriate song about, you know, whatever, body parts. Right. And he's like, "Oh, we're going to turn it down now." But it was just cool to be on that, you know. And
yeah, Bob and Tom, for people who don't know, Bob and Tom was sort of for a Midwestern. If you played the Midwest, it was like a Johnny Carson credit, as people would ask you, "Have you been on Bob and Tom?"
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a big step for you to get on there. That's as
it was huge. TV. Yeah, that was huge. I actually told Leno, I was like, "No, I'm doing Bob and Tom." I was like, "Not the Tonight Show. I'm not." No, I'm just kidding. No, but it was a huge thing, and to be on there like 12 times was pretty awesome. And
oh my gosh.
And so then, I mean, I still had the day job, and you know, it was funny because I would just tell my manager, "Hey, I'm going to be late tomorrow. Because I got to go do national radio," you know, because they're in 150 markets. And so no one was working in the office either, because they were all sitting around the radio listening to me, which was kind of funny.
Wow. So you're like the celebrity of the office.
Right. The bar is very low. The bar is very low.
It's Brenda in accounting, who was
pretty much
in a background.
Kelly, down on the Melody. Team, so, yeah. And Bruce. Yeah. And Mike was my manager. Yeah. But, So it was great. And then, but then we had this new manager come in from the outside, and he and I did not get along at all. And it was kind of this perfect storm of comedy wise. I was opening for Louis Anderson in Atlantic City. I was, you know, getting on Bob and Tom. I was, you know, friends with people that, you know, had been there. And so then I was like, wow, like, and then I had this new manager at work who was an idiot, a total idiot. And I did not respect him, and we had problems.
But you know, that's always kind of a blessing, is when you get, like, when a bad person forces your hand. I had that at my job, where it was like, you know, at some point you're going to choose this or comedy. And I was like, all right, comedy. So sometimes that guy, you should send him a thank you note and be like, "Hey, thanks for pushing me into comedy."
Yeah, no, I mean, that was exactly it. And then there was a manager in another department, and it's kind of what I speak on now when I speak to companies and do some consulting, is there was this manager in this other department, and he didn't know all the work I did, but he would just see me interacting with people, and there was laughter. And so he just thought that nothing's ever getting done. He didn't realize the amount of work I was actually doing. And so so we were in a pretty big meeting, and I called him out on something because he was wrong. And he's like, "Why don't you just go do comedy? That's all you want to do anyway." Wow. And I was like, whoa, time out. What I do after 5 o'clock has absolutely nothing to do with my ability to do a good job here while I'm in the office. Like, I can have something outside of work that doesn't interfere with my work. I mean, that's crazy. And it's unfortunate that a lot of people think that way. You know, the other manager, yeah, it was just kind of forced my hand. And I'm like, well, I remember I called Jimmy Brogan, who's a Notre Dame alum.
Right. Head writer for The Tonight Show with Leno. And yeah,
great. Yeah, yeah. And great. We still talk often. And Wayne Cotter, was an IBM guy in Philadelphia and left that to do stand up, later hosted A&E's Evening at the Improv. And I was talking with Wayne, and I was like, and he said, "What do you have to lose? You know, right. You have a college degree, you have a CPA designation, you can get a job in 2 days, you know?" And I was like, "Yeah, that's a good point." And I was like, "Can we three-way call my parents now?"
Right.
So, you know, I gave it a go, and you just hustle, you know, you just run as fast as you can to outrun the boogeyman.
How old were you when you did?
Yeah. So that was, February 2000. So I was 20, or no, February 2000 was my first time on stage. I was almost 24. And then, when I made that leap, that was 2005. So yeah, 29.
Okay. Yeah, that's when I did it too. I was 29. I moved to LA and, decided to do comedy full time. It's I think there is that thing in the back of your head of like, am I going to regret this if I don't do it now?
Yeah.
Because you hit that 30 mark, you're kind of like, what am I doing?
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing too, is, you know, I'm really careful to tell people to like follow your passions as a career, because it is hard. Like it is, I can't tell you how hard it is. Like unless you've done it, then you know how hard it is. I mean, you know, which obviously you do. But I mean, it's insanely difficult, and keeping it as a hobby is totally fine. It's totally cool. That works. And I equate it to people. It's like the Roadrunner cartoon with Wile E. Coyote, where you're on like roller skates and then the earth starts to split up and you try and keep roller skates on each side as far as you can.
Right.
And you have your day job and then you have your hobby, and keep those roller skates on both as long as possible, because there's a steady paycheck with health benefits and, you know, a social network, and all the people that are in your audiences as a comedian have day jobs. So if you have a day job, you can relate to them faster.
Right.
You know, there's so many benefits to it. But then at some point, if you're lucky enough, and there's only a few that are, then you're able to make that switch to where you get on one side or the other. But it's totally cool to ride both, you know?
Yeah, I did that for a while. And I mean, I think that's the saying, right? Is do what you love and never work a day in your life.
Right. Yeah.
And I think it is like, there is a lot of with stand up, you know, as far as waking up at 4 a.m. to get your flight and transferring flights if you got to transfer. And then if you're at a club, getting up that next morning and doing morning radio. And there is a lot of things. And if you listed that in the job description, you'd be like, nope.
Right, or when you started, it's like,
but when you're living it, it's fun. It's like it's you just kind of accept it and you make it part of the job, and you're doing something you love ultimately, which helps.
Yeah, no, it that's the only reason why that's why, you know, even for speakers now, but the same with comedians and new ones, I'm like, why do you want to do this? Mm-hmm. And if it's, well, because I saw so and so and I want to be like, nope. I want to be famous and rich. Nope. Because every single day you get punched in the face. every day, whether it's someone in the audience that doesn't laugh at a joke, or it's a manager, comedy. I once had a comedy club manager of a comedy club in Cleveland watch my demo and tell me that the accounting character that I was playing is very annoying. It's like, I'm not playing the personal attack. Like, I mean, I'm not Larry the Cable Guy. Like, I'm a real accountant.
Right.
Like, what do you mean this character I'm playing? Like, what are you talking about? Like, yeah. So, you know, just every day you get an insult or, somebody doesn't reply to an email. I have a friend that was looking for a job. And they're like, yeah, they never email me back. I'm like, yeah, how about that times 50 a day? That's what it's like. You know, like, well, just.
That's the story, like the Jim Carrey story about his dad, right? Is his dad wanted to be a comedian, I guess, and ended up being a janitor and worked at this place and then got laid off and they were homeless and living in a tent. And it's like, you know, he wasn't pursuing his dream and he was homeless. And it's like, so why not just pursue your dream and be homeless? and my brother is going through that now, where he was working at Deloitte.
Oh, yeah.
And he got laid off because of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And now he's the one who inspired me to get into comedy. And then he kind of went, you know, into the consulting business, that fly by night operation consulting.
Deloitte with quotes around it.
Right. But you know, to get laid off, and now he's like, hey, would you help me write? I want to write some comedy about, you know, about the pandemic or whatever, you know. So now it's like he's kind of realizing, like, oh, I kind of missed the boat on that. I want to, like, what you're doing is, which is, do what you love.
And, yeah.
What is your and? And I think for him, he was very funny, and he did inspire me to do comedy. So it's like,
yeah,
why did you leave that behind?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's you know, the what's your and? Yeah, I mean, it's you're a consultant and a comedy writer. You know, you can't separate one from the other. And it's unfortunate that in the corporate world, professional services especially, we've told ourselves, or professionalism tells us, this is how we have to behave, how we have to act. And, you know, if we have any interest outside of work, then we're not as dedicated to our career, or maybe we're not very good at it. And it couldn't be further from the truth.
Right.
And there's a study done at Duke University showed that people that have more dimensions to them, family, faith, hobbies, other interests, then you're less prone to anxiety and depression.
Right.
Because, you know, I mean, if your brother still had, you know, the comedy and other things, then yeah, you get let go, or you get some bad news from business or whatever, but you have these other sources of confidence and identity to be like, well, you know, but if it's all work all the time, then that's a 100% blow, you know, like just bam, you know, like it's, right. It's tough. And so we forget about these other pieces of who we are.
And I think with comedy, that's how I always looked at it. I wasn't just going to be a stand-up. I wanted to do improv. You know, I wanted to do acting. I wanted to do writing. I wanted to teach. And right. I think having all those aspects, even within comedy, like you said, it reduces a lot of that anxiety, because if one thing isn't working out, you've got another thing you can go toward.
Right.
And that's why I think comedians experience a lot of anxiety when it's just that one path of,
yeah,
and that's all I do.
Totally. And
they don't open themselves up to those possibilities.
Yeah, and it's even bigger than that too. It's having friends that don't do comedy.
Right.
I mean, that's huge for your mindset as a comedian. I mean, because man, you'll lose your mind if you hang out with comedians all the time. Like, oh my God. Like this is, I mean, it's fun, but it's also exhausting. You know, sometimes it's fun to hang around civilians, just like regular people, you know, and you know, what's going on in the real world that real people are actually dealing with.
Yeah. And you, so you were in Indianapolis for a while, and we actually crossed paths again in 2012. I came out to New York because I had
a
screenplay, and I was out there for the New York TV Festival, and you were nice enough to let me stay with you.
Oh, for sure,
How did you end up in New York? What brought you there?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was kind of like, you know, you're doing comedy in the Midwest, you're doing well, you're moving up. I was a pretty strong feature. I was split week headlining some clubs. And then was like, you know, no one's going to discover you, you know, at Snickers in Fort Wayne.
I just wrote about Snickers the other day about how I bombed there.
Yeah, then that means you were doing it right. That's one of those 50% fried cheese stick places where they would charge you for like, meanwhile, the owner pulls up in like an H2 Humvee and is complaining about not making money.
Right.
It's like, do you see my 12-year-old Civic? Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
You didn't go out of business. So we won in the end. So.
Yes, exactly. but yeah, so that's when I was like, you know, moved to New York. I mean, that's where I believe stand-up is probably strongest. I think Chicago's a little more the improv, and LA's, you know, the sketch and acting and stuff. But I mean, it was just like, it's so intense there. And it's just like, let's just jump into the deep end and see what happens.
And what year did you go out there?
Yeah, it was 2009.
Okay.
So, yeah. So.
And that really is, New York. I don't know. I've been out there a few times to do stand up and, did a few of the clubs, but it really does seem like, you're kind of thrown to the wolves. You really got to like get into the clubs. Were there, how did that process go when you moved out there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was definitely tough. Luckily, Jimmy Brogan had started at the Comic Strip, which was on the Upper East Side. And that was back in the day where there was Catch a Rising Star. And then, but you had to be like already a celebrity or pretty established, which was rare because comedy was barely a thing. Or the Comic Strip, which was where Seinfeld started and Eddie Murphy started and Paul Reiser and, I mean, Jimmy and Mark Schiff and so many others. And that was their, that's where they started, because that was for the JV team, if you will. Right. And so I went there. Richie Tinkin still owns and runs the place. And so you know, Jimmy said to say hi from him. And so that at least got me an audition spot to, you know, to do. But, you know, it's so hard there. And what I learned in New York was that it's more than just being a funny writer. You can write really great jokes, really great material. But then when you get to New York, it's no, I'm a funny person. I'm a funny person who wrote these funny jokes. So you have a lot more, you learn to get more confident and learn to just be, I'm a funny person and here it comes sort of a thing. But I mean, the New York City.
What do you mean by that, funny person? Do you mean like you're funny off stage, or you just mean like you live your life in a funny?
Well, I just mean like when you get on stage, because nothing's more obnoxious to me than the person that's always on. I feel like that's somebody that's not a really good comedian. That's just annoying. You know, funny things on occasion, yes, but always doing, you know, cracks. It's like, can you stop? Right. You know, like, are you trying more bits out right now? Like, we're having lunch, dude. Okay. Like, I'm asking you how life is. You know, don't go into a bit. What I mean is just that you get a lot more confident in who you are as a person. So then when you're on stage, you're like, you know what? I have a really good skill at writing good material that's funny, but I'm more than that. Like, I'm actually a funny person that wrote funny material.
Do you feel like it's no longer, like, as you get more into it, you become more of you comes out on the stage, yeah, as opposed to before where you're like, I'm putting on the persona of a comedian.
Yeah, sort of that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, where it's coming from inside you. And it's like, look, I'm funny. I own this place. Like, this is my thing. Like, right, you know, and as opposed to, I've got these really great tools that are going to make you laugh, right, type of
and
a
you,
thing.
Where, yeah. And I think that's part of it too, is where you can walk up on stage. Like, I know I'm funny. I know I can do this. I've done this 1,000 times.
Yeah.
And it's sort of that 10,000 hours, right? Of like,
yeah,
becoming, yeah, that's a lot. That's the hard part in stand-up, is that you learn by going up on stage in front of people.
Brutal. Yeah.
And yeah, it is brutal. And but that's the only way you learn. And as you get more comfortable, none of that affects you anymore. It's just like standing up in your living room and you just go talking.
Right.
And that's something you can't teach. That's just pure experience.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Exactly.
So, So you're out in New York, and like I said, we crossed paths, or I saw you again in 2012. So I think at that time you were doing some corporate stuff. And I remember, I think there was one day I couldn't stay with you because you were headed to Kansas to run a corporate gig. But I know even then you were kind of still in the beginnings of sort of your corporate career. And I there was some struggle with that, but
yeah, know. Well, I mean, it was certainly just, you know, the accountant in me was like, well, if I can do a show and make $75, or I can do a show and make $1,000, which one are you going to do? It's like, well, right, I'll do the $1,000 ones all day long. And I mean, my stand-up was always clean anyway. Right. You know, I don't have the face for being a tough guy that swears on stage. it's like when your 5-year-old nephew says a cuss word and you're like, that's cute, say it again. Right. You know, that's what happens when I get angry and drop an F-bomb on a comedy club. So right. Like, it doesn't have the effect it should. So my act was that anyway. So it wasn't hard for me. And maybe it's because partially, you know, just my look and who I am, but also partially, you know, I knew that if I was going to do radio, if I was going to do TV, if I was going to do anything like that, then I need to be able to have the jokes without F-bombs and without, right, you know, that kind of material. Because if you say it 1,000 times like that, and then for TV, they're like, okay, now you can't say, you're going to say it, because that's just how you've still told the joke so many times. And so I guess maybe it was the efficiency, maybe it was me being lazy. I'm not sure. But either way, I just didn't write that way. Right. And so to do the corporate audiences was kind of a natural fit, but, you know, it was, you know, purely entertainment. It was after dinner type shows. It was, you know, right, just, you know, just purely entertainment. And then over time, this is my breaking point, was in New York. I had auditioned for Letterman and was on the radar, if you will. Then I also had a connection with one of the producers, executive producers at Colbert Report. So I went to interview there. And it went great. It was pretty much for a field producer spot. So right. Anything that happens outside of the studio that Steven's going to do, I have the accountant brain that will keep us on budget. But I also have the creative brain that will, in the moment, be like, shoot it this way. This will be hilarious. Or here's an extra joke to do. Do that type of thing. And so it was pretty much a slam dunk. And then the next week, Letterman announces he's retiring. So there goes the Letterman spot. Right. And then about a week later, it is announced that Colbert is taking over for Letterman. So now Comedy Central has a hiring freeze. And two really cool things that I wish would have been part of my intro for this podcast did not happen. You know? And it's not because I'm not good. And it's not because, you know, I was
circumstances.
Yes, the universe, you know, just, and so that's when I was like, you know, I don't really control my own destiny, in the entertainment world. And I don't like that a lot. And so I was like, you know what, let's just take my accounting past and my comedy present, I guess, at the time, and let's just marry them together. So it was, you know, bringing mostly MC and a little bit of entertainment for the corporate, but then it's evolved now into where, you know, it's full on keynote thought leadership type stuff. You know, my book and research and podcast and stuff like that. And it's all just getting people to see that there's other parts to them. You know, you're so much more than what you do. I mean, you're so much more than a comedian, your brother's so much more than a consultant. I was clearly so much more than an accountant. And yet, no one really finds that out about us or wants to know type of thing.
Right. We bury that part of ourselves. And especially being creative, I think it's so important to add that, especially in the business environment, because you're so logic oriented. And when you let that creative side die, you kind of lose a part of yourself.
Oh, for sure.
And I think that's, I watched your video on your website about the green apple.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah.
And just how that sort of became your theme, right? That's sort of the theme in your corporate speaking. And you had a podcast called the Green Apple Podcast.
Right.
So did the podcast then inspire the book, or were you already?
Yeah. So it started where I was speaking at a conference. It was about 900 people in New Orleans. And I was speaking there and I was about to go on stage and I'm getting mic'd up by the AV team. And the meeting professional comes up and she says, hey, do you know this guy named Mark Bumgarner? And I'm like, I've never heard that name in my life. And she said, well, he knows you. He immediately pegged you on the list of speakers and said, I know John Garrett. That's the guy who did Comedy at Night. And I'm like, who the hell, like, do I owe this guy money? Like, what's going on? You know, like, and so so I went on stage and the whole time I'm up there, if I ever did a comedy special, I would want to do the video of the comedy, but the B-roll is what's actually going through my head as I'm doing the material, because it's like, why is that dude wearing those shoes? That's weird. Or how are they a couple? Really? Right. Like, you know, just all these things that are in your head that have nothing to do with the jokes.
All the things we do of even when we're doing our act, people don't realize, like, we're analyzing, like, oh, that person's getting up right now. Like,
yeah.
Oh, this person's going to sit down. That person's coughing. I got to slow this punchline down a little bit. Like,
yeah.
People don't realize that's why it takes all that time to become great at comedy, because we
learn
those subtleties.
Oh yeah. It's like having antenna all over the room. Just sensing, like, okay, you know, this side of the room's getting it faster than the other side. So I'm going to move a little bit closer to the side that's a little slow. Right. They clearly need me to be a little closer to them, you know, or look at them more or whatever it is. And so
they need like an ESPN sort of breakdown, like that with the like, you know, the chances of him catching it are 1.8%. They should do that with the chance of this joke working is 7%.
Right, exactly. And the angle of the way you're looking or whatever. Yeah.
Intonation. It's like slight inflection here makes
that would be hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so I researched who this guy was, and he was in my very first PwC office 12 years before that. And he was in the tax department, and I didn't ever do taxes. I don't know how taxes work. So I never met this guy. I never worked with this guy. And yet 12 years later, he remembers me. And I thought, well, if I'm the only one who had a hobby, well, that's easy because you remember one person. But then I started asking around, and no. And so I did my own research. It's 92% of professionals have a hobby or passion they regularly do outside of work. Right. And that means that we're all doing it. You know, the auditor in me says immaterial difference. It's 100%. You know, we all are.
Right.
And so it's just share it. So that's when I started the podcast, originally Green Apple Podcast. Now it's just What's Your And? What's Your And? And it just delves more into, you know, with the book and stuff like that as well. But yeah, it's just cool to hear every week of professionals that have a hobby outside of work. Let's talk about it.
And for the book, are you actually doing profiles on people, or is it mostly just sort of your journey, or what do you?
Yeah, think? It's my message, and it's styled similarly to The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield, which is an amazing book. If you haven't read it, definitely read it. It's a lot of micro chapters. It's about 190 pages. My book is, but they're all micro chapters. They're like a page or 3 pages long, so you can really burn through it. But there are 41 quotes from people that were on the podcast that are in the book that support what I'm talking about. So it's not just what I think in my little bubble brain. It's no, these are real life people that are telling you that this is how it applies in their world, sort of a thing, which is kind of cool too.
Yeah. Are you self-publishing it?
Yeah. So, well, it'll be published with Page Two. It's a hybrid publisher. So there are people from traditionally publishing houses in Toronto that started their own company for speakers and thought leader types. And so, so it's cool because I'll own all the rights. I get to determine, you know, I determined like the cover design, and I was in on the interior design. There are so many things in a book that it's like comedy. If somebody told you to write a book, you have to do all of these things, you would probably not do it. Right. But then, you know, I'm so far in now, but like, where's the page number go, and what kind of font is it, and how big are the margins? And I mean, all these different things where you're like, I had no idea. I've read so many books and I had no clue that all that mattered, you know, like it was just weird. So,
Who did you say wrote the foreword?
So Lou Holtz.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he was coach at Notre Dame when I was there my first 3 years.
So it's funny because my brother was there at the beginning of Holtz's.
Oh, okay.
So I mean, he graduated in '89.
Yeah.
So I remember going to, and this was when they were pretty average, but watching those games and seeing that transformation under Lou Holtz.
Yeah.
Was pretty amazing. And then obviously the early 90s under Lou Holtz were the glory days. How did you end up getting Lou Holtz?
Yeah, well, I was speaking at a conference last year in New Orleans, and I was the closing of the first day and he was the opening of the second day.
Okay.
And so I'm not normally super excited about the other speakers that I'm with necessarily. It's a lot of technical conferences and things. But, you know, it's Lou Holtz. I'm like, wow, that's freaking awesome. I will stay the night and then fly back the next day. And so I told the client about it. I showed him a picture that I had, actually this one right here from 1996 when I was a junior. So they said, well, you have to meet him. We're doing this super small private meet and greet after he's done with our biggest clients. It was a software company. And so if you want to come and, you know, that'd be great. We'd love to have you be a part of it. So I went and I just stayed in the back, you know, and everyone was asking him questions, and a lot of them were not, I mean, I was like, come on, really? If you had to ask Lou Holtz anything, this is your question. Right. But everyone kept calling it Lou, hey Lou, this, hey Lou. And so when it was done, he went to go pick up his briefcase, and I was like, hey, Coach Holtz. And he immediately like turned to me, because he's Coach Holtz, you know? Right. And so I said, you know, I had that picture on my phone, the digital, and I was like, hey, you know, we've actually met before. And he was like, that was on our trip to Dublin, Ireland, when we played Navy. Oh, wow. And I was like, that is exactly when that picture was. And so we chatted briefly. I said I was in the marching band, and he's a huge fan of the marching band. And so he said, you know, here's my business card. If you ever need anything, let me know. And I'm so Midwest that I've never asked anybody for help on things. But about 3 months later, I have that card sitting on my desk still now. And I emailed him and was like, hey, you know, I've got this book that's coming out. I'd love for you to write the foreword. And it actually dovetails nicely with some of his books as well. And so his assistant was like, I'll see the next day. He would absolutely love to. And there you go. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, people that are really good people that have already made it that want to help, you know, you know, I mean, I feel like you've had similar experiences too with, you know, with
others out there. And I was going to say, I think the two really great things you brought up is one, controlling your own destiny. You know, I released my stand-up special a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it is nice when you control it, when you decide what your cover is, when you are able to keep track of the money you're making.
Right. Right.
Like that's a huge thing. That's something I would encourage everyone, like, especially now you can do this all yourself.
Yeah.
It's a little more work, but the payoff is, you know, exponentially better.
Yeah. And if you're going to do it that way, definitely hire professionals that know what they're doing.
Right.
You know, I'm not making my cover. Like I have the, like Page Two has an in-house art team that I'm paying to do it. It's just, I'm providing some direction, you know, but hire people that know what they're doing. Like do not, you know, amateur hour it, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
Which you did clearly.
Yeah. And, the other thing was asking for help. And I think, just like you, I reached out, Drew Carey followed me on Twitter and I don't know why he follows me on Twitter. but he does, and I don't even know how we really know each other. I did open some of the, I hosted a lot of those shows at the Improv when they had Drew Carey night, so I don't know if that how it happened, but anyways, he followed me, and then I just decided to reach out to him, see if he would introduce me for my stand-up special, and he's like, I had to reach out to his assistant and his publicist, and some rules of like, we can't be on camera, and that, but I think that it is true. It's like, if you don't ask, you're never going to know. And I think those two things of controlling your destiny and asking people for help, which I know and you and I are very similar in that regard of like, we're hesitant, but that's the only way you're going to know is if you ask. And
And two, like someone explained to me one time just recently was, you know, not asking is equally not insulting, but like these people, like Drew wants the help. Like he's made it. He's doing great. And he's like, you know, if there's good people out there that I can help in some way, and you know, then that's great. You know, Lou's made it. You know, I mean, like, and if he's like, you know, hey, you're an alum, I've impacted your life, you know, you're in the marching band, whatever, we have a connection, then yeah, I'm happy to write your foreword. Like, why not? You know, and that's what's the cool thing I think about comedy as well, is that most of the people that have made it remember what it's like when they started. You know,
hopefully.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the ones that are the jerks are the ones that they don't feel like they're as famous as they should be. And I would name names, but I'm not going to. But like they just feel like I should have been more famous. You know, and it's like, everyone already knows your name. What more do you want? You know, type of a thing. And it's just not being grateful for where you're at and what you have. And just, you know, that's what another thing that I think is really important is just looking at your life and being like, I have it pretty good, you know, compared to so many other people. I mean, even when I was doing comedy, it was, you know, the clubs, you know, I'm booked 45, 50 weeks a year. Like, that's fantastic. I mean, you know, and well, I'm not, and it's like, whoa, slow down, buddy.
It's so easy to focus on what's not happening as opposed to what is happening. And I think that's sort of something you have to train your mind to do, a focus on the good things, not the things that aren't happening. Focus on the people that do like you, not the people that don't like you.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, those three things that we just mentioned about asking, you know, reaching out to people and doing things yourselves and focusing on the positive. I think those are three great
Yeah.
Great lessons for people. Yeah.
I mean, unless it's Tom Clark who doesn't like you, then you need to reassess your life. But
about four people I don't like. Exactly. I should have them all on.
You have them all on at once? They're all Cubs fans, I'm guessing.
Right. terrible people. Let's see. So the book comes out. When does the book come out?
Yeah, September 15th. Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. And yeah, I got pre-orders. It'll be Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop in Canada and Indigo. And yeah, so it'll be pretty cool to get it out there and see what happens.
You're going to miss out on that in-house book signings.
Right. Yeah, I know. But yeah. I'll do book plates. So I'll have stickers that then I'll sign and then mail to you. So
there you go.
That way. I'm as user-friendly as I can be here.
Will there be an audiobook?
Yes, on Audible. Yeah, absolutely. Because people have been hearing my voice so much on the podcast that how could you not miss this super Dave Osborne-ish voice reading a book to you?
I was hoping Lou Holtz was going to read it. That would be...
actually, that would be pretty fantastic. That would be pretty unbelievable. Right. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I appreciate it, John. Thank you so much. Again, what the title of the book?
Yeah, What's Your And? Unlock the Person Within the Professional.
And your website?
Yeah, whatsyourand.com. I make it idiot proof.
Awesome. Thank you so much, John. It was great to talk to you again.
No, the pleasure's all mine, Tom. It's super fun to catch up again.
All right. Thanks so much, John.